The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Michelle Saracini, and I'm the assistant here in the author events office. Before we begin, just our usual announcements. If you could please remember to turn off your cell phones. And also, after the discussion tonight, there will be a book signing upstairs in the lobby. Tonight, I expect we're going to hear and participate in a thoughtful and intense discussion about the legacy of race relations and the way that this legacy plays out in the current culture. And given the excitement about the primaries, it's hard to think of a more important or challenging topic. Our first presenter, Michael Klarman, is the James Monroe Distinguished Professor of Law and Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Before joining the university, he was a clerk for Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the U.S. Court of Appeals, and in 2005, he won the Bancroft Prize for From Jim Crow to Civil Rights, the Supreme Court and the Struggle for Racial Equality. Richard T. Ford is the George E. Osborne Professor of Law at Stanford Law School. He has published regularly on topics of civil rights, constitutional law, race relations, and anti-discrimination law. He is the author of Racial Culture, A Critique, and most recently, The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. Professor Klarman will present first, based on his new book, Unfinished Business, Racial Equality in American History. Please join me in welcoming Professor Klarman.
Thanks for coming. It's always a pleasure to be back in Philadelphia. This is where I went to college. I developed a lifelong appreciation of cheesesteaks, and it's always fun to be back. I'm going to talk to you about my book, Unfinished Business. The book has two principal virtues, if I'm permitted to say so. One is that it's short. The other is that it was officially released by Oxford University Press in October 2007, which is the same month that the Boston Red Sox won the World Series, and more importantly, the same month that the New York Yankees did not win the World Series for another year. So I feel privileged to have published my book in that auspicious month, and I'm here to bring you good tidings from Red Sox Nation, which, as you may not know, extends as far south as Charlottesville these days. I'm going to make 8 points about the history of American race relations. I'm going to offer you an illustration of each of those 8 discrete points, talking about why race relations changed over time, how they changed over time, and I'll limit myself, I think, to no more than 20 minutes. First point, racial progress in American history has not been ineluctable. I think there's a conventional narrative that suggests we've had a steady progress and we're always moving forward. If you think about that narrative, the United States had slavery both in the North and the South before the Revolutionary War. Then, as a result of the Revolutionary War, slavery was gradually phased out in the North. It continued to exist in the South, but then was eliminated as a result of the Civil War. Slavery was then replaced with a regime of white supremacy that historians refer to with the term Jim Crow. That regime was gradually undermined over the course of the 20th century before it was eliminated through some combination of the Supreme Court's decision in Brown versus Board of Education and the 1960s civil rights movement. That's the conventional narrative. I want to suggest it's deeply misleading. In fact, there have been periods of progress, but there have also been clear periods when race has regressed, when there's been a regression in racial attitudes and practices. I could give you several illustrations, but I'm just going to note the most salient one to save some time. During Reconstruction in the 1870s, blacks could vote in the South and indeed turned out to vote in huge numbers. There were hundreds or thousands of black office holders. Blacks served on juries. Many southern states passed laws forbidding race discrimination in public accommodations. 30 or 40 years later, blacks in the South had been all but universally disfranchised. Blacks no longer served on juries. There were no longer any black office holders. The number of blacks being lynched every year had increased to an average of 100 a year. There's no doubt that African Americans in the South were worse off in 1900 or 1910 than they had been in 1870. Second point, racial progress has not primarily been a result of whites doing the right thing. Again, I think there's a kind of narrative that is misleading. This narrative is exemplified by Gunnar Myrdal, the famous Swedish sociologist who wrote an important book on race relations during World War II called An American Dilemma. According to the Myrdal thesis, there is this American creed of racial equality, which is stated in the Declaration of Independence, and American history has been a process in which attitudes and practices have gradually evolved toward that self-evident norm of racial equality. I think that's not true. I think African Americans have had to fight for every inch of progress that's been made, and I think that racial conditions, that larger social, political, economic conditions have had to be ripe for racial progress to be made. So those are the second and third points I want to make, the second point being African Americans having to struggle for all the progress that's been made, and the third point, conditions having to be ripe for progress to be accomplished. On the point about African Americans struggling for change, again, I'll just offer one illustration, although there are lots of others that one might talk about. In the 1960s, when the Kennedy administration got behind the Civil Rights Act in the summer of 1963, the law that ultimately became the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the administration acted not primarily because it was the right thing to do. After all, it had been the right thing to do in 1961 or 1962. The administration got behind the bill in 1963 because of the Birmingham street demonstrations, because when Bull Connor unleashed the police dogs and the fire hoses on peaceful black demonstrators, most of the nation, which was watching on television, was appalled, and the administration faced pressure to do something to solve this problem. It was only after the Birmingham demonstrations that President Kennedy went on national television and announced that the civil rights issue was as old as the scriptures and as clear as the Constitution. Third point, African Americans struggling for their rights, demanding their rights, has not been sufficient. It's also been the case that conditions, external, political, social, economic conditions, have had to be ripe for racial change to take place. There are lots of deep-seated forces one might talk about. Again, I'll just mention one, which I think in many ways is the most important. It's known by historians as the Great Migration. It's what transported 5 million African Americans over half a century from the rural South to the urban North. This began during World War I when industrial economic opportunities opened for the first time in American history for African Americans. That's what drew them to northern cities like Chicago and Detroit. One important consequence, this was not the motivation, but one important consequence of the Great Migration was that African Americans relocated from a part of the nation where they were almost universally disenfranchised to a part of the nation where they could not only vote nearly without racial restriction, but where they often held the balance of power between two evenly divided political parties who now bid for the black vote. In addition, in the North, African Americans found access to better education, and of course it's hard to imagine a social reform movement being successful without an educated leadership and probably an educated group at the grassroots level. Blacks had been drawn to the North primarily by better economic opportunities that enabled the development of a black middle class, which ultimately possessed the wealth and the resources to support social reform movements. In addition, in the North, African Americans confronted somewhat looser racial mores, which enabled the development of militant protest organizations such as the NAACP, or militant newspapers such as the Chicago Defender. Those sorts of newspapers, which were aggressively pursuing civil rights, would not have been possible in the southern states in the first decades of the 20th century. I want to emphasize that it's almost impossible to reform a near totalitarian system such as white supremacy entirely from within. African Americans in the South could not vote, so they could not use political power to leverage change. They had few economic resources in the South, where most blacks were tenant farmers and sharecroppers. They weren't educated. They weren't allowed to become very well educated, so they couldn't become lawyers. And they had very little protection from physical violence in an era when African Americans still faced significant risk of lynching. External pressure is essential to changing such a system. That pressure was largely supplied through Northern blacks influencing whites in the North and ultimately the national government to try to intervene to destroy white supremacy in the South. I think that's how to understand the NAACP's drive for anti-lynching legislation in the 1920s. It's mostly a product of Northern congressmen with large black constituencies trying to appeal to their black constituents to promote national legislation which will intervene to fix a Southern race problem. That's also largely how to understand the NAACP in its first decades of existence. It's primarily a Northern organization oriented toward promoting racial change in the South. Now, I talked about one long-term factor. I also want to mention one short-term factor that I think has been indispensable for racial progress in American history. That turns out, perhaps somewhat ironically, to be war. The Revolutionary War played a critical role in putting slavery on the road to extinction in the North, as well as temporarily weakening the institution in the South, although that effect didn't last very long. The Civil War, of course, ended slavery as well as resulting in post-war constitutional amendments that secured a certain measure of civil and political equality for African Americans. Perhaps less well known to people, World War II was a watershed in the history of modern race relations. I think that's true for several reasons. One is the anti-fascist, pro-democracy ideology of the war forced Americans to reconsider their racial views because this war to attack Nazi fascism was being fought with a segregated army, and that struck many Americans as paradoxical. Second factor, nearly a million African Americans served in the army during World War II. They were fighting for democracy, but when they returned home to Alabama or Mississippi, they were deprived of the most basic right of democratic citizenship. They were not allowed to vote. Third factor is an acceleration of the Great Migration in the 1940s. Another 1.5 million African Americans relocated from the rural South to the urban North. This was having a profound effect on national politics and the politics of race by the late 1940s. And then the final factor is known by historians as the Cold War imperative for racial change. After World War II ends, the Cold War begins. It's a struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union for the allegiance of the Third World. Most of the Third World is not white, and American racial discrimination and racial atrocities is the number one propaganda weapon of the Soviet Union to try to convince blacks in Africa or people who are not white in Asia or South America that American democratic capitalism is synonymous with white supremacy. It was necessary, in other words, for the United States to do something about its racial regime in order to compete against the Soviet Union for the allegiance of the Third World. These four factors were having a dramatic effect on American race relations by the late 40s, early 50s. Jackie Robinson, with an assist from Branch Rickey, desegregated Major League Baseball in 1947. President Truman issued his famous executive orders desegregating the American military and the Federal Civil Service in the summer of 1948. The first black law clerk in the history of the Supreme Court served for Justice Frankfurter in 1947-1948. Even in the South, one can see dramatic changes taking place by this time. Black voter registration in the Southern states increased fourfold in the decade in the 1940s. For the first time since Reconstruction, or at least the late 19th century, blacks are serving on juries again in the South by the late 1940s. Blacks are starting to win election to local political office in Southern cities by the late 1940s. Even in deep South cities like Montgomery and Alabama, they're desegregating their minor league baseball teams by the late 40s, early 50s. Next point, fourth point, Racial progress in American history has often been an unintended consequence of actions that were taken for other reasons. My principal example here, maybe the only example to save some time, the North initially fought the Civil War not to end slavery, but to preserve the Union. As late as the summer of 1961, several months into the war, Congress passed resolutions declaring the objective of the war and denying that the war was about slavery. The war was a war to preserve the Union. I think most historians would agree if the South had laid down arms any time in the first 12 months of the war, the Southern states probably could have held on to their slaves. This ultimately changed. The war wasn't going well. President Lincoln decided by the summer of 1862 that it was necessary to take desperate measures. The Emancipation Proclamation is an effort to encourage Southern slaves to leave their plantations to free themselves, thus undermining the South's labor supply. And then ultimately, if you enroll these former slaves into the Union military, you are going to increase the North's manpower advantage in the Army. Northerners did not initially fight the war to end slavery, but of course, ultimately, the war was transformed into a war against slavery, and slavery was abolished as a result of the 13th Amendment, which was enacted immediately after the war. It's worth noting, however, that turning the war into a war against slavery was incredibly controversial. The Republican Party lost literally dozens of seats in the 1862 congressional elections, partly as a result of the Emancipation Proclamation being so controversial, and the proclamation directly led to race riots, including the famous draft riot in the summer of 1863 in New York City, as Irish-American working-class Catholics revolted, literally revolted, against the idea of being conscripted into an army fighting for the freedom of slaves. So the war ultimately ended slavery, but that's not necessarily why it was undertaken. Fifth point, whites have often had ulterior motives for the racially progressive positions they have adopted. I'll offer two quick illustrations here, one alluding to something I already mentioned. Republicans, when they adopted the 15th Amendment in 1870 enfranchising blacks, did so at least as much because they knew blacks would vote for the party of Lincoln and the party of emancipation as because they thought it was the right thing to do. And in fact, that's what happened. African Americans, not surprisingly, voted by numbers of at least 90% for the Party of Emancipation as opposed to the Democratic Party, which then was still the party of open white supremacy. After World War II, my second example, whenever the Truman administration or the Eisenhower administration took racially progressive positions, it was often largely inspired by this Cold War imperative. When the Justice Department in Brown versus Board of Education urged the justices to strike down racial segregation, their principal argument was a quotation from the State Department, which was not known as a bastion of racial progressivism, but the State Department told the justices through the Justice Department brief, you must strike down segregation because racial discrimination is grist for the Soviet propaganda mills. In other words, the justices were asked as a matter of national security to strike a blow for progressive racial change. Sixth point, there is an important, though I think not widely understood, dynamic by which racial progress has occurred in American history. I think it's actually the same dynamic that works in the 1850s and in the 1950s, but I'm just going to talk about the earlier period, and if people are curious, you can ask questions. We can talk about this more in the question and answer. Here's the dynamic. The North and the South begin with somewhat different racial regimes. They don't have to be all that different. The North has put slavery on the road to extinction, but the North is no racial paradise. Blacks are largely disfranchised. They're largely excluded from public education. They're denied access to jury service and so forth. So the North and South start out with slightly different racial regimes. Southerners become paranoid and defensive that the North is going to intervene against the Southern system of slavery. For example, Northern abolitionists encourage Southern slaves to escape, and Southerners respond by demanding from the national government a more efficient fugitive slave law, which they get in 1850. Then you get these scenes in northern cities, especially Boston, but also in other places like Syracuse or even in, I believe, Christiana, Pennsylvania. You get these scenes of fugitive slaves being dragged back into slavery, wearing shackles, often with the assistance of federal troops. And this has the effect of driving many more northerners who don't have much exposure to slavery on a day-to-day basis, but now suddenly have seen it rearing its ugly head in their backyards. This drives them into the abolitionist camp. Northerners become more alienated from slavery. That in turn leads Southerners to demand even greater safeguards and protection from the federal government. So by 1860, Southerners are actually asking Congress to pass a slave code for the federal territories. That repulses Northerners even more. They are driven into the camp of the Republican Party, which is committed by its platform to eradicating slavery from the territories. Northerners elect a Republican president. That drives Southerners, at least in the Deep South, into secession because Abraham Lincoln is an alien entity. He's not even competing in the South for votes. So you see this dynamic. Initial changes get exacerbated over time. One side becomes defensive. It starts asking for greater security. That simply repulses the other side, and the gap between them widens until ultimately you get a rupture. I think that's the same dynamic that produces the civil rights legislation in the 1960s. Okay, the last two points I want to talk about have to do with the Supreme Court. Both Rich and I are law professors, so I feel some obligation in my talk. There's some focus in the book about the Supreme Court and its role in racial progress and racial regression over time. So two points I want to make about the Supreme Court. The first is the Supreme Court has not been a predictable ally of progressive racial change. In fact, more often than not, the court has been on the regressive side rather than the progressive side of racial issues. And then the last point will be a point about the Supreme Court and its relationship to public opinion. I want to suggest that the court's decisions, both progressive and regressive, have largely reflected public opinion in the nation. Okay, so the first point about the court and whether it's been progressive or regressive. Before the Civil War, the Supreme Court was a consistent ally of slave-owning interests. The Supreme Court, in a case from Pennsylvania in 1842, Prigg versus Pennsylvania, not only upheld the federal fugitive slave law against constitutional challenge, but struck down an effort by the state of Pennsylvania to protect its free black citizens from being kidnapped into slavery. In the infamous Dred Scott case in 1857, the Supreme Court not only struck down federal efforts to restrict slavery in federal territories, but also held that even free blacks had no rights that white people were bound to respect. After the Civil War, the court, in a series of decisions, reversed the criminal convictions of people who had lynched or perpetrated racial massacres upon blacks, as well as striking down the federal civil rights statute of 1875. In the early 20th century, the court on several occasions upheld segregation as well as southern state mechanisms for disenfranchising black voters. In the last four decades since the end of the Warren Court in the late 1960s, the Supreme Court more often than not has struck down affirmative action programs as well as measures designed to promote minority political representation. Last year, as I'm sure many of you are aware, the Roberts Court held that it violated the 14th Amendment for school districts to voluntarily take race into account in trying to promote integration in public grade schools. That decision, I would suggest to you, is an extraordinary perversion of the original understanding of the 14th Amendment by justices who profess to be committed to originalist methodologies of interpretation. It's really only for the half century between 1915 and the end of the Warren Court that the Supreme Court was a fairly reliable supporter of progressive racial change. Last point, I would suggest all the court's rulings, both progressive and regressive, have tended broadly to reflect public opinion. That is, the court has not been a resister of public opinion, but rather has been a sort of mirror of public opinion on the race issue. When the court in 1944 struck down the white primary, which was the primary mechanism for excluding African Americans from political participation in the South, opinion polls showed that roughly 70% of Americans supported federal intervention to try to prevent Southern states from disenfranchising African Americans. When the Supreme Court decided Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, opinion polls showed that roughly half the country, a very narrow majority, supported the court's decision from the day it was handed down. So even when the court has favored the interests of racial minorities, it's largely been reflecting rather than resisting dominant public opinion. In other words, the mythical view of the court as a heroic defender of minority rights is largely belied by its track record on the race issue. Now, to be fair, if we note that the court's progressive decisions have largely reflected public opinion, we probably ought to note that its regressive decisions have also largely reflected public opinion. If I'm not going to give the court a great deal of credit for its progressive decisions, perhaps I shouldn't give it a great deal of blame for its regressive rulings. When the court said in 1857 that African Americans had no rights that white people were bound to respect, it was surely reflecting dominant opinion in the country. African Americans in 1857 were allowed to vote only in five New England states, which together had 6% of the North's black population, and the North only had 10% of the nation's black population. So in other words, blacks could only vote in the part of the country where almost no blacks lived. In northern states, blacks were everywhere segregated in schools, as in Pennsylvania, or excluded entirely from public education, as in Indiana or Illinois. Several northwestern states actually had state constitutional provisions barring free blacks from migrating into those states by the 1850s. There's no doubt in 1857 Dred Scott reflected majority opinion in the country. In 1896, when the court ruled in Plessy that racial segregation was permissible under the 14th Amendment, the court again was almost certainly reflecting dominant white opinion in the country. Even the Republican Party, the Party of Lincoln, and the Party of Emancipation by 1896 had largely given up on defending the civil rights of African Americans. National newspapers barely noticed the Plessy decision, much less criticize it. The New York Times, for example, reported it in a page three column on railroad news because the case involved railroad segregation. They didn't even see it as a race case. It was a case involving regulation of railroads. Most of the country greeted Plessy with a yawn of indifference. Even the decision last summer in 2007, where the court said you cannot voluntarily use race to promote integration in public schools, I think it's worth noting, even with that decision, only 5 or 10% of school districts in the country continue to use those sorts of methods. So I think it would be fair to say the Supreme Court intervened to strike down these race-conscious methods to promote integration at a time that most of the country had given up on the idea that government ought to be promoting integration. Okay, thank you very much. Look forward to your questions.
Hi, thanks for coming tonight to hear me talk a bit about this book. I'd like to read from the book in several places because a lot of what I'm trying to do in the book is to evoke a climate that I think characterizes race relations today, and the book will allow me to do that, some of the language from that. But first I'd like to frame it up a little bit. Kind of following along with what Michael said, I want to argue, and one of the main points of the book is that we can tell a kind of good news, bad news story about race and race relations. And the problem with racial discourse today is that people tend to want to tell one or the other. On the one hand, the bad news, racial segregation in many American cities is worse than it was during the era of Jim Crow. The isolation of the black poor is worse than it was in the era of Jim Crow. The incarceration rates of African Americans, particularly black men, is much worse than during the era of Jim Crow. My home state of California spends an astounding amount of money keeping people, mainly people of color, in jail. And the United States spends more on prisons than any advanced industrialized nation in the world by many times over. The joblessness in the black community is worse than in the Jim Crow era. In certain aspects, in certain parts of the black community, I should say, the underclass. The good news, racial attitudes are almost certainly better, indeed much better, than they were 40 years ago, and probably better than they were even 10 or 15 years ago. By any reliable sociological measure, there's less racism among whites, and this is in part a result of the partial success of the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement, I think, succeeded dramatically in making racism taboo. So people not only try to hide their bigotry if they have it, but I think it's fair to say that they try to keep it under wraps, that the majority of Americans don't want to be bigots, and they don't want to discriminate on the basis of race. So there's a good news, bad news story, and the trick is trying to understand how we explain the bad news consistent with the good news. And what we do now in talking about race is ricochet from a scandal to scandal. And we have a series of conversations about race involving relatively trivial and phony scandals and never or very rarely conversations about the underlying problem. So we worry about what Don Imus said about the Rutgers basketball team, a man who's paid to be offensive. His contract requires him to be offensive, and so surprise, surprise, he said something offensive. But what we should be talking about is racial segregation in Newark and Camden, and that's not a conversation we have. This ricocheting from scandal to scandal produces two results, both of which I think are bad for race relations. One, we don't have the opportunity to talk about the real and underlying problems, many of which don't involve bigots today, but instead involve the legacies of discrimination in the past, instead involve class hierarchy, instead involve changes in the economy that have disproportionately affected African Americans. And at the same time, because it's hard to draw attention to these problems, tend to make accusations of bigotry and bias in contexts where they're not appropriate. And this leads to an attitude of defensiveness and digging in of heels. So we get a kind of tit for tat. You're a racist. No, I'm not a racist. You're just playing the race card. And that dynamic has, in many cases, exacerbated racial tensions and made it harder for us to deal with the real and underlying problems. And so there's a lot of dissembling and bluffing on all sides, and that's why the subtitle of the book is How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. We're in a context in which people hide their bigotry, so it's hard to tell whether someone's a bigot or not. But we know, given the extent of racial injustices and racial inequities, that there's some bigots out there. If I stand on the corner in Manhattan and try to hail a cab and six of them pass me by, and this is all commonly used as an example of modern bigotry, I don't know whether any individual cab driver was a bigot or whether they just didn't see me or whether they had some other reason. But after a while, I start to suspect that some of them are. So I'd like to give you three examples from the book that attempt to illustrate these points. And there's some... My hope is to evoke some of the tension that surrounded these conflicts. Okay, first example. The year 1991 marked an end of an era in American civil rights. Thurgood Marshall, the first black Supreme Court justice, the lead attorney for the NAACP in the historic racial desegregation case Brown versus Board of Education, announced his intention to retire from the bench. Immediately, the speculation and maneuvering began concerning Marshall's replacement. It was widely expected that another African-American would be, indeed would have to be, appointed. Liberals and civil rights groups began a predictable campaign directed at the Republican president, George H.W. Bush, who would nominate Marshall's successor. It was crucial, they insisted, that the nation's highest court include a person of color. The Bush administration would demonstrate the racial insensitivity, indeed bigotry, that its enemies had long suspected if it appointed a white person to fill this vacancy. Partisan politics and ideological litmus tests surely must be put aside in this instance. Marshall's vacancy should be filled by a person who could understand and express the unique experience of people of color in this country. If it had its druthers, the Bush administration would certainly appoint a conservative. And the most prominent conservative judges were white. But Republicans couldn't afford to ignore the race issue. Part of the GOP's long-term strategy involved improving its dismal level of support among minorities. But the party couldn't shake its reputation as racially insensitive or downright racist. Its long-lived Southern strategy relied on race baiting to deliver white votes to GOP candidates. Bush had been elected, in part, on the strength of a notorious ad campaign that many felt had exploited racial bigotry. The ad pilloried Democratic candidate Michael Dukakis for supporting a program that allowed prison inmates to take furloughs from incarceration. The ad informed the public that a convicted murderer, Willie Horton, had beat a man and raped his fiancée after returning from furlough. The ad prominently featured Horton's menacing black face, complete with shaggy Black Panther afro and beard. Bush's campaign manager, Lee Atwater, crowed, "By the time this election is over, Willie Horton will be a household name." He didn't exaggerate. The ad may have helped Bush win the election, but it didn't help the Republicans improve their standing with African Americans. Bush faced a dilemma. If he nominated a white conservative to the Supreme Court, it reinforced the perception that he and the Republicans were insensitive to racial justice, hostile to civil rights, maybe even closet racists. But the black judges with the stature and experience for the position were, by and large, civil rights liberals. But conservatives had an ace up their sleeves. A black conservative with just enough experience to be a plausible candidate, but not so much to have left a long paper trail of controversial published opinions. One can imagine the number of champagne corks that popped the night someone made his career in conservative politics with the suggestion Clarence Thomas. It was racial politics jujitsu. Use the enemy's strength against him. We have to pick a black nominee? Fine. We'll give you a black nominee so conservative he makes Edmund Burke look like Che Guevara. And are the quota crazy affirmative action liberals going to say that a black candidate is unqualified? Conservatives were buying confetti and chilling bottles of Krug when Anita Hill turned up in the district. Hill was a prim young black woman who had worked with Thomas on the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She claimed that Thomas had sexually harassed her following a classic pattern. He asked her out, she declined, and he started hassling her with off-color jokes and references to porn. Hill was a believable accuser in large part because it was hard to imagine that this proper young woman could have invented a story that included a porn star named Long Dong Silver and references to pubic hair on a can of Diet Coke. Someone had to have exposed her to these ideas. Not that Thomas was an obvious suspect, this tightly wound man, impeccably sexless in beltway standard gray flannel and blue serge. But look closely enough and you could almost see it. The leer, the gleam in the eyes, the licking of the lips. Could he be Willie Horton's kith and kin after all? A sexual predator dressed up for court? The Senate confirmation hearings began as a duller-than-average legal theory symposium involving issues such as fidelity to the Constitution and the meaning of penumbral rights. After Hill's accusations, they morphed into a Jerry Springer episode that had put on airs. The nation witnessed a parade of disgruntled former co-workers, jilted ex-lovers, and other character witnesses testifying to the integrity or duplicity of Thomas and Hill. The Clarence and Anita show offered the viewing public that most comfortable scene of American pop theater, wherein the vain and cocky black man gets taken down a notch or two by the headstrong black woman. Hill played a demure Sapphire Stevens to Thomas's somber Amos Jones, with EEOC colleague and Thomas supporter John Doggett making a cameo as Kingfish Stevens. The daytime drama came to a head when a beleaguered Thomas described the hearings as a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks. Although race had thus far served as a silent inoculation against critique, here it was deployed openly as a full-strength antibiotic. Thomas sought to link his struggle to sit on the highest court in the United States to the struggles of African Americans to avoid physical mutilation, torture, and death. He compared milquetoast Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee to an angry mob armed with firearms and strong rope. No one dared openly scoff, but many found the analogy harder to swallow than a Diet Cola of dubious purity. The irony of the moment was striking even in this, a drama that Oscar Wilde could have penned. Thomas, a corrosive skeptic of accusations of racism during his tenure at the EEOC, cried racism the moment his nomination was in real jeopardy. When the chips were down and the stakes were high, the staunch defender of colored blindness shamelessly played the race card. But the race card is not a simple matter of opportunism and deception. It's a byproduct of deep ideological conflict in our society over how to describe and deal with questions of social justice. When bigotry was openly tolerated, people often announced or did nothing to conceal it. Therefore, many of the earliest struggles for civil rights aimed at some fairly conspicuous targets: Jim Crow laws, blatantly discriminatory practices, and out-and-out race-based exclusion. But today, a lot of people try to hide their prejudices, and as a result, a lot of time and energy must be spent simply trying to determine whether bigotry is in play or not. Everyone involved, accuser and accused alike, has an incentive to lie and dissemble, to downplay or to exaggerate. And as overt prejudice has receded, we've developed new theories of prejudice designed to tease out hidden or repressed motivations and to identify inadvertent forms of wrongful discrimination. This has given rise to a lot of conflict over how to define bigotry and how to decide whether or not it's at work. When does a grievance deserve the special and unequivocal condemnation reserved for racism? Despite more than a century of litigation under the Constitution and federal civil rights laws, we still don't have a straightforward answer to that question. In fact, in some ways, the answer is getting more convoluted and confusing, and the resulting conflicts more numerous and more frustrating. Quickly, example two. In the summer of 2006, The Economist magazine informed the hoi polloi that serious champagne drinkers sip only the prestige cuvées produced by a handful of winemakers. The article quoted Jean-Claude Rousseau, the former manager of the Louis Roederer House, who opined that a $300 bottle of Roederer's Cristal champagne was intended for that 3-5% of consumers who really know wine and take the time to taste it correctly. Under the subheading, Unwelcome Attention, the article went on to note what any moderately attentive student of American pop culture already knows. The most conspicuous consumers of high-end champagne, Cristal in particular, are not enophiles of highly refined sensibility, but rather, and I quote the article, rap artists whose taste for swigging bubbly in clubs is less a sign of a refined palate than a passion for a bling-bling lifestyle that includes 10-carat diamond studs, chunky gold jewelry, pimped-up caddies, and sensuous women. When asked how the venerable House of Roederer feels about all this, the new director, Frederick Rousseau, this was the first Rousseau's son, took the bait. What can we do? I can't forbid people from buying it. I'm sure Dom Perignon or Krug would be delighted to have their business. Days after the publication of the article, the hip-hop artist Jay-Z announced a boycott. It has come to my attention that the managing director of Cristal views the hip-hop culture as unwelcome attention. I view his comments as racist, and I will no longer support any of his products. What are we to make of a boycott, the time-honored tactic of the struggle for basic civil rights, of prestige cuvée champagne? Why, when black unemployment, poverty, rates of incarceration, and life expectancy remain severe and unaddressed problems, did anyone pay a moment's attention to the offhand comment of a representative of a vintner with roots in pre-revolutionary France? Jay-Z talked the line of a scrappy civil rights activist, but with the inflections of a jilted socialite. Jay-Z will now be serving only Krug and Dom Perignon, sniffed the press release. When a young, black, self-described hustler from Brooklyn seems as precious as a Park Avenue debutante, maybe we've turned some sort of a corner in race relations. But where are we headed? Is Mr. Rousseau's wary, although not overly hostile or contemptuous, reaction to hip-hop racist, as Jay-Z insists? Rousseau's comments might have reflected racism, we don't want blacks drinking our wine, but they might have reflected concern over the association of the brand with an ostentatious subculture that sometimes extols violence and crime. Do we think the reaction would have been much different had, say, the notorious British punk band The Sex Pistols embraced Cristal champagne during the band's heyday in the 1970s? It would have been fair enough for Jay-Z to boycott Cristal because Rousseau insulted the hip-hop culture of which he is a part, but that wouldn't have made headlines or garnered much sympathy. By contrast, racism from the director of a well-known international company is news and guarantees the instinctive condemnation of millions of people. Because Rousseau's statement was subject to multiple interpretations, one had a choice of whether to frame the insult narrowly in terms of hip-hop or broadly in terms of race. It's not surprising that the personally affronted Jay-Z chose the latter. Having done so, he triggered a chain of predictable, indeed reflexive, reactions. Contemporary racial politics often makes it a virtue to assume the worst when confronted with such ambiguous circumstances. The person who assumes the best of others and offers plausible alternatives to the verdict of racism is typically dismissed as naive or even complicit in racial injustice. This presumption of guilt leads people to play the race card, and it effectively silences those who would call their bluff. But at the same time, presuming the worst is understandable in a society in which racism persists but is rarely openly expressed. If Rousseau is a racist, he certainly wouldn't announce it, but he might inadvertently reveal his prejudice in the context of an interview about a bunch of black nouveau riches who guzzle his finest cuvée like it was cheap malt liquor. People who are regularly at risk of suffering from concealed racism can't afford to take Pollyanna's perspective. A marked man had better always look for hidden assassins. A black person marked by race for social contempt had better always look for hidden bigotry. I had one more example, but I think I'd rather stop and take your questions. So I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you to our professors. Folks, the way this works, put your hand up, we'll get a mic to you. And who would like to start us off? We'll start all the way in the back with the lady and her hand up.
My question is, why is it deemed racist to oppose affirmative action when blacks have been going to Ivy League and other colleges and universities long before there was affirmative action? Ralph Bunche is one.
Why is it deemed racist? I don't think it's racist to oppose affirmative action. My own view is that affirmative action is a sound policy that's justified and makes sense in certain contexts, but I don't think that the people who oppose it are all racists. So, I can't really answer your question because I don't agree with the premise.
I don't think it's necessarily racist to oppose affirmative action. I suppose it depends what the motive of the person opposing it is. As a law professor, when you ask the question, what I think is whether affirmative action is good policy or bad policy, I'm not sure why it's unconstitutional. And the justices who are committed to holding it unconstitutional are adopting methodologies that repudiate their usual approach to constitutional law. So on the Supreme Court today, the leaders of the commitment to colorblindness are Justices Scalia and Thomas, There are also justices who profess that they're committed to deferring to legislatures, to deferring to state governments, local decision-making, and they claim that when they interpret the Constitution, they do it according to the original understanding, yet the original understanding of the 14th Amendment, according to almost no constitutional historians, was a commitment to colorblindness. So when you apply inconsistent methodologies on issues involving race, I start to wonder a little bit what the explanation is. I think I agree with Rich for the most part that a lot of what counts as what I would call regressive racial positions today are not the sort of open, notorious racism of the Jim Crow era, but rather what you might call what some constitutional theorists have called selective indifference or unconscious discrimination. You know, what happened in New Orleans and was revealed to the nation, I don't think is a result of sadistic people in Washington hating blacks, but I do think it is a result of selective indifference, and that if it were largely white people who were dying in the aftermath of the hurricane, there would be a different reaction. So I guess I think the same thing about resistance to affirmative action. I think a lot of the resistance to affirmative action is not the sort of sadistic, malicious racism of the Jim Crow era. It is a kind of selective indifference that gets people riled up when we're trying to help black people, but if we're trying to help someone else, they'd have a very different reaction.
Another question. All the way in the back here on my left. Sir, could you keep your hand up?
Why do you think the press does such a poor job of covering these serious questions that you were describing, Professor Ford? And where are the why aren't the organizations that are committed to civil rights more effective at forcing the press to cover these issues?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think part of the reason the press is so bad at covering these issues is because the press is attracted to spectacle. And it's a lot more spectacular to hear about someone who blurts out a racial epithet than it is to talk about the day-to-day underlying conditions that everyone's aware of, but that don't have, a spectacular incident to provoke them. So you don't hear much about segregation until there's a riot. And then even then maybe you don't hear about segregation, although the segregation is in large part what caused the riot. So I think that's part of it. I think that civil rights organizations haven't been as effective, in part because it's hard to break through the media without some sort of a spectacle. And so to some extent, they've been caught up in the same dynamic where they too will look for a racist in order to get some attention. You know, we need a spectacle, we need a scandal, we need somebody that we can say is a racist in order to get this issue on the table. And we'll focus on that, and that can lead to, and often does lead to, distracting attention away from the underlying problems. When we looked at the horrible incidents in Jena, Louisiana, one of the things that got lost underneath that, and I think the real reason that people were so upset about what happened in Jena and the underlying issue had to do with the war on drugs and the high incarceration rate of African Americans generally all over the country. But we didn't get to have that conversation. Instead, we had a conversation about whether this particular DA was a bigot, which is something that you couldn't really prove one way or the other. And so everyone's kind of locked into this discourse of scandal and blame and recrimination. And I don't have a good answer about how to break out of it, but I do think I have a diagnosis of the problem.
The other question, gentleman here on my right.
I'll address this question to both of you. What is your take on the seeming double standard of Haitian as well as Cubans, et cetera, refugees in their attempt to come to this country?
Wow. This is an example. In my book, I've got a chapter called Racism Without Racists, and I think this is an example of politics, you know, that the treatment of Cuban refugees in this country has everything to do with the history of anti-communist politics and has everything to do with the political strength of Cubans in Miami, and that's a constituency that the government responds to in a way that it doesn't respond to a constituency supporting Haitian refugees. And I think that's a big part of the issue. I wouldn't go so far as to say that race has nothing to do with it, but I do think that it doesn't explain the disparity, that you know, politics is a big part of the issue there.
Michael, did you want to add anything to that?
I don't have much to add. I mean, the history of immigration restrictions in the United States is a history that's rife with race discrimination. The first Exclusion Act was in 1882, the Chinese Exclusion Act. It wasn't even clear the national government has any constitutional power to exclude people, but the Supreme Court said that was inherent in the power of the national government in the context of excluding Chinese. There were racial quotas for most of the 20th century. I don't think there's any reason to think that a lot of the anti-immigrant sentiment today is also rooted in racism. I don't think it all is, but I think it would not be surprising, given the history of the debate in the United States, if a lot of it wasn't.
Time for a few more questions. Right here in the middle. Either one. We'll just pass it down the line.
Just hypothetically, say Barack Obama wins the presidential election. How does that change the discussion? And how, you know, the peculiar, you know, aspects of having, you know, a mixed race individual running for presidency, like people already discussing the possibility of his assassination before he even wins the nomination. You know, is this, you know, how does this affect the discussion? Can we actually start to talk about real things, or does this precipitate, you know, the big event that you know, puts this back on the table?
Well, I mean, I have a couple of thoughts. One, and this is in line with what Rich started his talk saying, I think it's, you know, inconceivable 40 years ago, probably 20 years ago, that you could have an African-American elected president of the United States. I think now, and I'm not saying anything that isn't reflected in the betting odds, the odds are better than not that Obama will win the Democratic nomination. And when he wins it, the odds are better than not that he'll be elected president. It's not a certainty, but I think the probability of each is more than 50%. That's extraordinary. In the United States, that, I think, was inconceivable until quite recently. It's probably notable that it's only possible for that to happen when he doesn't talk a lot about race in his campaign. I think the symbolism of the presidency is enormous. People, you know, have largely forgotten, although maybe not everybody in this audience, how extraordinary it was for John F. Kennedy to be elected as a Catholic in 1960. I think that had an enormous effect on the gradual assimilation of Catholics into the mainstream in the United States so that it's no longer an issue. Most people in the country aren't aware that there are five Catholics on the United States Supreme Court today. That would have been inconceivable 50 years ago, and yet today I think most people in this room are probably not even aware that that's true. I think having a black president will make it seem more natural and less extraordinary to people. I think it will have a huge effect on the on the international scene and the way other countries view the United States. I don't know what sort of effect it has on racial policy. You know, my guess is Obama will be interested in the issues that Rich is reminding us people don't really seem to want to focus on and talk about. I don't know whether he'll be more successful at doing so. I have a hard time believing that he won't be interested in trying to direct attention there.
Yeah, I think this is part of this good news, bad news story. On the one hand, it reflects a real significant change in racial politics of a certain kind, and I think it's been telling that at every step along the way, the naysayers have said, oh, okay, he can't win. Okay, he won in Iowa, but it's just because it was a caucus and everyone knew how everyone else was voting. But the Bradley effect, the Tom Bradley effect, is referring to the mayor of Los Angeles who ran for governor in California, looked like he had a lot of support, but then when it came down to it, he lost the election. The Bradley effect will take over and he'll lose in the states where there's a primary, and then New Hampshire happened and people said, aha, there it is. But now, not plausible any longer. And so we have seen some change in racial attitudes. And the demographics, whites in red states in the Midwest, in places without large black populations, voting overwhelmingly for Obama. At the same time, I would be concerned if people said this is going to transform race relations in the United States. I mean, following along with what Michael said, it doesn't do anything about the terrible conditions of the black underclass in American cities. And so we've had this real separation of African Americans who were able to take advantage of the reforms of the civil rights movement and African Americans who for various reasons were not. And those who were not are as badly off and in some cases worse off than they were before Jim Crow. And it's important that we not forget that even as we correctly celebrate progress with Obama and, if he becomes president.
I have time for one more question. There's a man with his hand up over here.
This isn't maybe as much a question as it is just a request for commentary on a phenomenon that sprang up some years ago, which was sometime in the past 10 or 15 years, a few people, I don't know if this has had a long shelf life, began saying things like, in particular, these were black individuals who were accused of being racists or engaging in racist practices. And the response was, I can't be a racist. A racist can only be a member of a group that is in power. And I remember reading that at the time and thinking to myself, that sounds like a kind of moving of the goalposts or shifting the fences because, my recollection growing up was that, and I grew up in the 60s, that, the prototypical racist could be a poor southern white man who really had very limited power, though he was a member of a group, but that what mattered was what you thought and what you felt and how that drove your actions. And so I guess I'm just wondering if there's anything worth commenting about this phenomenon.
It's an interesting question. I think, one of the things this gets at is the way that the term racism is in a state of crisis, that it has a lot of different meanings and there's no one agreed upon meaning and so it's manipulable in the way that you're describing. Now, I think that when people say that, I can't be a racist, what they're trying to get at is what makes racism so destructive. Is it's the way that it's embedded in a set of institutions and in a set of habitual practices that have profound effects on entire communities. And I think that's right. But at the same time, the level of individual condemnation, it seems to be, does attach regardless. And your point about poor Southern whites is well taken there. So, part of what I'd hope to be able to do is develop a more precise definition of racism, but also be able to talk about racial injustices that may or may not involve racists, and have a broader conversation about why it is that we should be concerned about certain types of bigotry and bias more than others. That there is a difference between racism directed at African Americans and, let's say, reverse racism. That those have profoundly different social effects in most circumstances, and the reasons that we would be concerned about them to a different degree, and that to some extent we haven't had that conversation, but what we've had is a lot of, kind of gerrymandering of the term racism, which has been confusing and has led to, I think, a lot of frustration.
So I want to say something, and I think I'm agreeing with Rich, but I'm going to offer two illustrations maybe that are more concrete, and it's a very interesting question. But take the way that the Roberts Court used Brown versus Board of Education and the NAACP's argument in Brown versus Board of Education to defend the decision saying you can't take race into account to promote integration. I think that's an illustration of what you're talking about. You're sort of saying there's a double standard. The NAACP in 1954 urged colorblindness. They said it's wrong for government to know the race of children in assigning them to schools. And yet, that's exactly what these school boards are doing in Seattle and Louisville. They are assigning students partly based on race. And so if the NAACP thought in 1954 that's unconstitutional, then they ought to be willing to live with that 50 years later. I think that's an illustration of what you're talking about. The response to that, and I think this is what Rich is saying, it's contextual. It's simplistic to say these are the same things. The NAACP was arguing that taking race into account to segregate students is wrong, and here we're taking race into account to integrate students. It's true you can use the language. They were urging colorblindness, but they were urging it in the context of trying to get away from white-imposed racial segregation. Let's take another example. Think of an African-American community wanting to set up segregated academies for black males. And some white people would say, but wait a second, you argued that racial segregation was unconstitutional. Now you're trying to set up, you know, in Detroit, an academy that excludes whites. Well, is it the same thing? I think it's not the same thing, right? It's certainly not identical. It has some commonalities. In both cases, you have the government making decisions based on race. But in one occasion, it was white Southerners embracing the view that blacks are inferior and are not good enough to integrate. And in another context, it's an African-American community saying, given the political and social environment, we think black children will benefit from having this unique, supportive, nurturing environment. So it's not identical, right? There are commonalities, but there are also differences. And I think that's what I would really, you know, emphasize. I don't know if it's a common standard, right? If you're talking about a black nationalist in the 1960s saying white people are devils, that sounds to me like the same sort of race discrimination. And to say it's not, I think, sounds like a double standard. But to talk about, you know, black nationalism in the context of, you know, we should segregate our schools and we should support black businesses, that doesn't strike me as the same thing as white supremacy, Jim Crow. So I think we have to be sensitive to differences in context. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Great conversation, folks. We have to end it there. Please thank our scholars.
Thank you.
Richard Ford.
I love Darwin.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.